We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's... or maybe it's more like... altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Russell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime, and lots of other places. And my second script is done and in being worked on, in the works, so to say.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently trying to make my third one, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who used to work at Sundance. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 201 from March 2019 with director Jesse Hanscher, who talks about making his feature documentary, Being Napoleon. We thought this was a good match for Brenton because both are stories about making feature documentaries, and both filmmakers worked in corporate video to pay the bills. After that, we play another round of You're the Expat. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. It is what keeps our show going. Thank you so much for being a part of it. Don't forget to give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. And without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Jesse Hanscher.
Mark and I have both worked for Jesse on various corporate video projects, but today we're going to talk mostly about his documentary feature filmmaking projects. Jesse is a producer and director. His latest documentary, Being Napoleon, is currently on Netflix, and he's gearing up production on his follow-up feature about the ultra-competitive world of high school basketball in neighborhoods of Portland, Oregon. Is that a reasonable summary, Jesse? Of what that film's about?
I think so. Ultra competitive sounds about right. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Good.
And also, I guess one other correction is that I wouldn't say you've worked for me. You've worked with me on different things. So let's just throw that out there.
For you?
Yeah. I feel like it was collaborative.
I would say with, but Isaac says for. I mean, you did pay us.
True.
So I guess, you know, you could say for or with either one.
Right.
I feel like it makes you seem better than us, which is
right.
Which is true.
And then now you have to report that income on your taxes because it's on this podcast.
Right. Yeah, definitely did. I had a question. I was going to say, is that a reasonable bio for you, though? Or is that just like a very, like, is there anything else that Isaac left off about, like, you know, what you do, who you are?
We're about to get into that. We're about to have his version of.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Well, sure. But I want to. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Like you're not the host today, all right?
Okay. Well, I am. I'm always
well,
the host.
I mean, you have the document, too. Feel like if you want to delete a word, but don't change it right after I say it.
Okay. Well, all right. Whatever. I don't know.
I mean, if you can make live
Carry on.
So
none of this is being cut, by the way. Anyways, sorry. go ahead.
Now we're starting.
So, Jesse, what do you say when someone asks you what you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's like always a hard question. I know you guys probably struggle with that same thing. I think that, you know, if nine different people ask me what I do, I'm going to give them nine different answers. And I don't think that's necessarily like a deficiency or anything that's, you know, unclear about what I do, but it's just kind of the nature of what we do. You know, I say I'm a producer. I say I'm a director. I say I run a production company. I say I'm a filmmaker, a content developer. And each of those answers is usually correct. You know, I think it kind of depends on who I'm talking to or kind of the last project I did. And I think that ultimately, like, you know, I like to say that I am a filmmaker, but I don't want to limit that or limit myself to only making films. You know, obviously we've made shorter form videos and commercials and kind of nonprofit content. So, you know, I guess I usually say that I'm a filmmaker who also directs, produces, occasionally edits, develops all types of videos. And, you know, the people that ask me kind of get in this mode of like, they're kind of more confused after I answer them than before, because there are so many things that we do. But I think ultimately, you know, I think to be a little cliche, we are basically storytellers, and what we can do is we can tell a story about, you know, we can tell a story in a film form. We can tell a story with just interviews, a corporation, about videos, however we want to tell these stories. That's what we do. And we make it look beautiful at the same time. So,
tell people that you own your own production company? Cause that's a pretty easy answer. That's also true.
Yeah, I do. And that makes it sound like I have 55 people working for me at all times. But, you know, I think that's a good way to sell yourself, I guess, or sell what you do, because, you know, I think when we're talking about with clients, like they want to know that you can handle everything. So they don't want to have to hire somebody who's going to do all the pre-production and then hire someone else who's going to do the production and then we'll have to worry about the editing and all that kind of stuff. They kind of want a one-stop shop for that. And, you know, if I'm not doing everything, there's people I'm working with and hiring like you guys who are doing stuff. So, you know, I think a production company is, I do say that, but a lot of times, you know, I'm kind of talking about what I do specifically in different productions. And, you know, that does vary whether it is just producing or just directing. And ultimately, like, you know, I'm most interested in talking about the films that I've worked on or that I'm working on. And so I usually lead with the filmmaker, kind of job title, but that's also something that can be, you know, it sounds a little hoity toity, I guess, you know, sometimes.
Right. It's very nebulous or something.
Yeah.
I say it sometimes too, but I'm like, what does that even mean?
It's like it's my hobby, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just a filmmaker and you know, but yeah. It's a good question. It's a good question because I think all of us have a hard time. I mean, we're not just like, I'm a high school teacher. Like that'd be a very easy answer. You know, I think we do a lot of different things, not to take anything away from high school teachers, but they, you know, it's like, it's really hard.
We have an important job.
Yeah.
We have.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, that's exactly. So. Yeah, but it's a good question because it's really something that is hard to pinpoint every time. You know, every project is so different, you know.
Cool. Can I move along to this next question, which is going back kind of further, how you got into
you're the host.
Filmmaking or video production, just a more deep dive into the bio, but kind of earlier on in your life, whenever that was.
Yeah, so, you know, when I went to college, I studied history, and I mean that, which wasn't really necessarily a decision of like, I love history so much that I want to study it. That kind of, you know, it was like the third major I had. None of them were filmmaking at all or related to it. When I was growing up, I, you know, I love film and I love, you know, narratives and documentaries. And I, you know, I think that I thought, back then that it was something that I was really interested in, but I didn't really see how tangible it was to work in it, I guess. I didn't really know anybody in filmmaking. I didn't know really how to get into it. And I knew all the stereotypes of, like, you know, you got to get coffee for people for 5 years and all that kind of stuff. And that just wasn't interesting to me at all. But I started taking some screenwriting classes during college and after college. And I really liked that. And I was able to kind of, you know, I felt like I was pretty good at that. And I could relate that to my interest in film. And then a friend I made is a film director. And I started working with him on just some projects that he had, like just rewriting scripts and like being on set with him. And he did, like, you know, stuff completely opposite that I do. Like, you know, he was doing like horror films and like, you know, narratives and all this kind of, you know, things that I'm probably never going to do as a filmmaker. But, you know, I kind of like broke down the barrier of seeing that it was possible to work in this industry, I guess. And from there, you know, I just kind of tried different things. And I, you know, realized that, you know, if you know how to do like one or two things of the 25 things it takes to make film or video, then you can start working it and you can kind of start learning how to do everything else, just like any other job, you know, just like being a lawyer, I guess, where, you know, you learn a little bit in law school, but you just, by working in it, you learn how to do everything. And that's kind of like how I started. Yeah, basically, you know, just kind of started like both at the same time, getting some corporate clients. And then I got really interested in this when the NFL and concussion stuff was going on. And I met a few people who were also interested in doing a film about that. And that was kind of the first documentary film I did. And it was great. And I learned a ton doing that. And that's kind of how it all started. So, I mean, yeah, I think there's like a little bit of an element of like faking it till you make it as there is with everything. But as long as you can kind of hold your own or pull your weight in some aspect of it, then you can like learn everything else. Yeah.
So really quickly, Jesse, what school did you go to and where'd you go to school?
I went to UC Davis in beautiful Davis, California, right outside of Sacramento, which is a school that is primarily known for their agriculture. And, you know, their biggest event of the year is called Picnic Day, where they show off all the giant tomatoes and cucumbers they've grown in their farming classes. So it's really not notoriously a filmmaking school at all.
Right.
In fact, I don't. Yeah.
So did you just come straight to San Francisco out of Davis? And did you, before you went into filmmaking out of college, did you do any other jobs first? Or did you just like immediately say, hey, I want to do this filmmaking thing?
Yeah. I mean, I went to San Francisco and I worked, I did some like paralegal stuff. And then I was in kind of like public policy research, like for a couple years. History research kind of stuff that I had been doing in college, which, you know, I think also like really did help in the documentary world. I mean, not the production part. This might be kind of boring for your listeners, but basically like just the idea of knowing how to like research a topic and like get deep into like something that, you know, if it's like an issue or a social issue, you know, that's something that I learned how to do in college that I was able to transfer to documentary filmmaking. So I spent about 4 or 5 years working. About 4 years working before I kind of transitioned. And the transition was kind of slow. I mean, I was still working and then working with my director friend for a little bit before I kind of took the plunge after that.
And who was your director friend? Has he done movies that anybody would have heard of? Or are they like really small horror films? Or...
Yeah, they're pretty small. His name is Phil Flores. I don't know if he's...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I've heard him on a podcast. He's one of the Butcher Brothers, right?
Yeah, good. You know him. Yes, he is. Yeah, I don't know if they're still making films together, but I mean, they're, you know, they grew up together.
Yeah, I think they're both doing stuff separately now.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he's down in LA now. Phil is.
And yeah.
I think Mitch is up here, or up in you know, the Bay Area. So, it's good that you know them.
Yeah, my producer, Jeff Allard, who's working on my movie, he works with those guys, or I had worked with those guys a bunch.
Yeah, he's worked a lot with them. Yeah, I know Jeff.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I saw in your movie that he had a special thanks, and I was wondering where the connection is. And
Jeff Allen,
I know you know. Yeah.
Oh.
And yeah, and being Napoleon, I was like.
I think he might have just like donated money in the Indiegogo thing, to be honest.
But oh, okay. Is that how you got the special thanks? Is that why I'm on there too? Because I just donated money.
Are you on there? Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
What else did you do for it? I guess I don't know.
Gave you some notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched it early.
I mean, I guess you could have gotten two special things. Like, you could have said your name twice.
No, I don't think so. I think I was just there because of the Kickstarter. That makes much more sense now. I felt really special when I saw that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm sorry. We got derailed here. So
can I ask another derailing question?
Yes.
Did you have a specific focus as a history major, or like was there some part that...
I was, I think, technically like an American history major, but I mean, yeah, that was my focus. But I think it was like, from what I remember, I think it was just one more class you had to take to make it, you know, so like if I took 8 American history classes, that was my focus. And I probably could have taken 7, you know, European history classes, but I, you know, that one extra class made it my focus and everything else didn't matter. So
cool. So that's like technically, but then I guess within your heart, was there a focus or a part that like excited you most, or that you like may still dig into in your documentary career or have?
Well, I don't know about a film, but my favorite professor was this guy named Spiridakis. That was his last name. And I don't know what his first name was, but he was this old Greek guy who was like the most demonstrative lecturer I've ever seen. And he would like tell these, he taught basically Roman and Greek history. And he had these ridiculous tangential stories about like the orgies and stuff that Romans had, and all the, you know, all these college kids were like, you know, writing down their notes about orgies and whatnot. And like everyone went to class. Like he was, you know, the most popular teacher out there because he had these crazy stories. So I remember him very well. I think he's still there, actually. He's probably like 75 years old, but he was great. Yeah, I don't know if it was like, it wasn't, you know, the content that was my favorite, but he was the best teacher by far. In fact, probably the only professor I remember the name of from Davis. So what about you guys? What was your guys' majors?
I think we got to keep this on you.
Well, yeah. I mean, radio television. Isaac can tell you if he wants to.
I did film and also politics.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Good to know.
But Isaac, you've been saying for years, and, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but that, like, you know, as a filmmaker, it's really good to have other interests and other things that you do. And that, like, if you've had a past career before you're a filmmaker, it's like you have all that knowledge and things to gain from to, like, you know, go out and tell your stories and make your movies, which, you know, I mean, I've done other things when I was younger, but I mainly just, like, was always been wanting to make movies. And so I was like, you know, 17, 16.
I think that's a reasonable thing to say. Whether or not I've said it for years, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Why no? I mean, I think you have said it for years. So, you know, whatever. but anyways, I'm just going to jump to Isaac's next question, which I think you already kind of answered, is like, you know, but not really. Like how, when you're doing this stuff with Phil and like, you know, working on his horror movies or helping out or whatever you're doing, why did you already know that you wanted to not do that and do documentaries? Like, what drew you to doing, you know, nonfiction stories when you were like surrounded by these like fiction films?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, I was thinking about that. I don't think that there was necessarily like a point that I kind of transitioned over or whatever, but, as like technology started getting better with cameras and everything, it became a lot easier to make documentary films that were, that weren't the kind of the cookie cutter stuff of the past. It was like boring office interviews and kind of the same stuff that every documentary film had. Like from a excitement standpoint and a creative standpoint, documentaries, you know, from 12 years and further in the past were kind of, they were a little boring and they could get a little stale, I think. And so I think that was a little bit of a turn off in general for me. But as I saw documentaries get a little, and there's obviously exceptions to the, to that over the years, but like, as I saw documentaries get more creative, and it seemed like that was, it just interested me more basically, over time. You know, I think, you know, they became closer to narrative styles, or, you know, you could kind of meld a narrative and documentary, together, which is cool. You know, I've always been interested in like these kind of people that do certain things, like subcultures, like for example, that we'll talk about the Napoleon film, you know, it's about reenactors who are like spend all their free time reenacting the, you know, Napoleonic history and battles and life like that. And to me, that's something that's so foreign to me that it's really interesting to see why people do that kind of stuff. I've never really been so much interested in all the just social issue documentaries. It's more about a character or a subculture or type, a person, like why people do certain things. And I think generally, you know, documentaries were kind of evolved into having more of those stories as opposed to like, you know, here's a really big social issue that needs to be told and kind of told in a cookie cutter way. So I think, yeah, I think once I kind of realized that and recognized that, I started to see stories that were out there that I thought I could work on, that I tried to work on, and some, you know, some were viable and some kind of fell by the wayside. But like, yeah, it was just, you know, and also just to make a documentary is a lot easier and, you know, not as costly as a narrative film. You don't have to get a crew of 50 people to work on something, you know, but as you know, Isaac, with your Bob Frank documentary, but I know it's about me. you know, it's easier to start. And it's, I think it's really fun that these stories can evolve and kind of change and you have to adapt with them, you know, with an narrative.
Right,
yeah. Go ahead.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's, or maybe it's more like, altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Yeah, that's definitely something, right? Everyone who listens to this podcast, I think, is like hearing Ulrich go through the struggle of trying to get the alternate going. And you and I, right, because it's documentary, can more or less, you know, even while trying to raise money or whatever, can just grab a camera or grab another you know, whatever,
yeah,
make it happen. But so on that note, and you just mentioned being Napoleon, which is the last feature-length doc you did, currently on Netflix now, as I mentioned earlier. So we can just maybe segue into that.
Sure.
what is meaningful, and is that too? Go ahead.
Before that, like, so is this the first movie that you directed as like by yourself, like for a documentary, or did you do one before this?
Well, the only other like major documentary that I worked on before this was the NFL. It turned into a documentary series, which was called Casualties of the Gridiron, which is about NFL players, like former NFL players that are dealing with like with head injuries and other substance issues from playing football. But that was, I co-directed that with someone named Isaac Solotaroff in New York. And that was more of like, you know, even though we both got co-director credits, I think he took more of the lead. He had a lot more experience, and a lot of the characters were in New York where he lived. So this was like, you know, a much bigger jump into having the directorial control, I guess. I mean, I actually co-directed this one as well with a guy in Belgium, being Napoleon. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily only my project, but we kind of took different parts of it and directed it solely. I mean, just because we were 7,000 miles apart, I don't even know how far away Belgium is, but 6,000. So, you know, I think as each project that I've done is kind of, I've taken on more responsibility in directing.
That's interesting. Cause yeah. I didn't notice that you co-directed this. I didn't see the other guy's name, in the credits. I know. I wasn't paying attention, I guess.
You were just looking for your name.
I was just looking for my name.
Yeah.
I'm just terrible.
Yeah. No, it was, it was interesting. I mean, you know, being in San Francisco at the time and working with somebody in Belgium, it's a 9-hour time difference. We had like 1 or 2 hours a day where we crossed over being awake, basically. And could be frustrating to like talk about the project, you know, as, I mean, it worked out because we kind of took on different parts of it, but that was a pretty challenging part of the project, you know, making sure we're on the same page with everything.
That's kind of a question I was going to ask about later, how that worked.
Sure.
But maybe we can come back to it then.
Yeah, we'll say
there's more context.
Good.
What is Being Napoleon? What's kind of a general intro to the movie?
So Being Napoleon is, it's a documentary film, feature length film that looks at the world of Napoleonic reenactment. So this is mainly men, but some women who spend their weekends and sometimes all of their vacations portraying Napoleonic soldiers, basically. Anyone from a foot soldier to Napoleon himself. And they do this at different, you know, reenactment events, some small, like, you know, 15 people getting together for a weekend in some campsite, whether it's in the States or Europe. All the way to reenacting Waterloo, the Battle for Waterloo, where Napoleon lost. So the film follows several characters as they are preparing for and participating in the Battle for Waterloo 200 year anniversary, which was billed as like the biggest reenactment the world has ever seen. Which it was the biggest reenactment I've ever seen. I haven't seen many, but this was, you know. At the actual battle site in Waterloo, Belgium, they built a stadium around this farm. So, you know, people could come and watch it. I think there was like 60,000 spectators, for 2 days. So yeah, so we basically followed these different characters in this year leading up to it. And the main storyline, is about these two Napoleon reenactors, one American, one French, who are, you know, bitter rivals in this world of Napoleonic reenactment, who are trying to become Napoleon, to be chosen as Napoleon for the Battle for Waterloo reenactment, which happened in June 2015. So, you know, the French guy's named Frank and the American Mark, and they both kind of have dedicated their lives to portraying Napoleon at these reenactments, and there can only be one Napoleon at these things. You know, history tells us there wasn't two. So they tried to jockey and position themselves to be chosen to be Napoleon at this battle, ironically, the battle that Napoleon is most famous for losing. So that's the story.
And how did you get involved in, like, how did you come to know that this exists or become interested in it? How did this project get going?
It was kind of a random occurrence, I guess. I mean, this co-director of mine, he's a friend, his name's Olivier Roland, and he lived in Los Angeles for many years, and I knew him, and he grew up in Belgium. So he moved back to Belgium in 2014 with his wife and two kids. And we had lunch, like, literally, I think, like, literally as they were going to the airport to move to Belgium. And we were talking about doing some project together because he works in film too. And we're thinking, okay, let's do something about Belgium. Let's figure out, you know, something interesting, some documentary, you know. And I didn't know anything about, I knew Belgian beer. So we started talking about Belgian beer. We started trying to figure out a project that would be involved with, you know, getting into a monastery and figuring out how the monks make this incredible beer and blah, blah, blah. And there was kind of no story there besides, you know, the attraction of, like, okay, let's go drink beer with, you know, in Belgium. But that kind of fizzled out. And then a couple of weeks later, he called me and he said, that there was this, you know, basically this reenactment that was happening in a year, a few minutes from his house, where they were going to reenact the 200th anniversary of the Battle for Waterloo. And apparently they were going to, you know, make this a huge international event. And he said, maybe there's something there. So we started doing some research. And, like, the first thing I found was this article from the Wall Street Journal that was about these two Napoleon reenactors, the American guy and the French guy. And it was basically, you know, had some crazy title, like, you know, two Napoleon reenactors are going for their Waterloo, something weird and, like, mysterious, but also really interesting. And the article is just about how much they kind of hated each other and were rivals. And so I sent this to Olivier and we're like, we have to do this. This is amazing. This is, like, the strangest thing I've ever heard in my life. And that's kind of how it started. And from there we, you know, contacted the two Napoleons. They reluctantly, I guess, kind of agreed to be a part of this. And then we got into this world and met all these other characters who were just, like, amazing characters in this film. You know, maybe we'll talk about it. So one of the things that made it kind of easy for us is that these guys are, already very comfortable in public and very comfortable in front of cameras. They're like, they want to be in front of the camera. So I think a big problem with documentaries a lot of times is just convincing people to be in front of the camera and to, you know, to, like, actually schedule a shoot and be comfortable and act like themselves. And these reenactors were, like, it was so simple. Like, anytime we showed up to any event to shoot, everybody wanted to be in it. And it wasn't like them, you know, they weren't being too pushy, but they were being very comfortable being themselves on camera. And that made it very simple to kind of get a real story out of it. So we just started going from, like, August of 2014 to June of 2015 is when the reenactment was. So we had a really short time period, to work in, and kind of try to draw the story out that way, which was a challenge. But, that's how we did it.
So did you go to Europe every time they shot anything, or Olivier shot anything for the documentary? Like, or did he shoot some stuff on his own and you shoot some stuff on your own, or how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, ideally it would have been great if we could have gone, you know, traveled that much, but, no, I mean, we didn't have enough funding to do that. I think I went probably three times in a year and a half, which is a lot, I guess. But, a lot of times, if there's anything going on that wasn't, like, a major thing in Europe, Olivier handled it. We had a DP out there who was in Brussels, who we used a lot. So we basically, a lot of the work we did was, like, figuring out what the shot list should be and then just trusting the other person is going to direct it in a way that we both agree on, which worked for the most part. And obviously a lot of the stuff you know, we just had to kind of do it on the fly and adapt at these events. And anything in the U.S., there was less reenactments, but the, you know, one of the two main characters was in the U.S. So I shot a lot with him, myself, and, you know, with DP here. But, you know, I think, you know, sometimes it actually worked out better because having co-directors in the same place can be a little confusing for everybody. I mean, we have to really, you know, especially in the beginning when we weren't so practiced being co-directors together, you know, we would kind of maybe contradict each other or kind of both try to direct at the same time. And that could be confusing for people, even in a documentary. But, you know, a lot of the events, like the actual reenactment, the Waterloo reenactment, we were both directing in different places at the same time. So that was kind of a necessary, it was such a huge event that we had two different crews going. And, you know, so at times it was really beneficial for that. And just like, and just in the whole development side of it, you know, having, you know, two different people working on and, you know, developing content, developing ideas was great. You know, one of the other issues that kind of came up that I had no idea about was that this kind of European versus US like sentiment in terms of what viewers want to see. So, I would say the biggest argument we had, you know, kind of continual argument in the film was, should we focus on these two Napoleons as like a conflict? Like they're battling, they're rivals. Someone has to win. Or should we focus, which was like kind of the American, we love conflict sentiment and you know, we want to see someone win. We want to see a villain, all this kind of stuff, and a hero in Europe. And what Olivier was focusing on more is like just being in the moment and kind of like the verite style of like, okay, we're just going to go walk with these foot soldiers for a day. And if something happens, something happens. But if it doesn't, then it's just, that's what it's like to be a soldier, you know, more of just the kind of being with them, kind of vibe. So, you know, it was an interesting kind of push and pull on that. And it turns out that we used both. We kind of went back and forth in the film, you know, between the conflict between the two Napoleons and the idea of just being with, you know, with the soldiers as the soldiers were, basically.
I think that's really interesting. I'm usually kind of anti, I mean, for myself, the idea of co-directors, it just never makes sense in my head. Like, how can there be two directors? Mm-hmm. Unless there's like, you know, maybe it works out with like siblings because they, you know, from, you know, spend their whole lives together and they're, you know, like two parts of the same brain somehow. I always have trouble wrapping my head around how it would work to actually co-direct. But the way you've explained this, I was like, oh, this seems like the perfect project for that. One, right? I mean, well, you're shooting in the U.S., he's shooting in Europe, and, yeah, you know, being able to have two crews, each with a director at the actual battle. And even the things you're talking about with the European sensibility versus, like, American sensibility, I think that's interesting, too, how that kind of plays out in the movie and works really well.
Yeah.
And also, the movie is a battle between this, like, French Napoleon and American Napoleon. So, interesting. This is a project that definitely makes me rethink some of my conceptions about co-directing.
Yeah, but you'll probably still never do it, though.
Well, I'm not making this project.
Right. But I mean, yeah, I think it is specifically interesting that it's like there's a duality there between what's happening in the story and then what's happening behind the scenes, you know?
I mean, I don't think I'd recommend it a lot. I think, you know, there can be times. I don't think when we started it, it wasn't really like, oh, we have to co-direct because there's going to be so much to do. And it was just kind of like, let's do something together. And then I think we might have thought that it was going to be one person was going to be more on the creative directing side and one person was going to be more on set. And just kind of because of the nature of like not having that much money for it, we just kind of had to like for every single shoot, figure out what was the best scenario. So then we kind of co-directed that way, I guess. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, I think it could work. Yeah, but you're right, Isaac. I think most of the co-directors are like our brothers or siblings. So, you know,
well, it's becoming more popular now. I mean, you see a lot of co-directors out there in the world. And we've had like three, I think, sets on the show alone.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I know like two others that we haven't had.
The Perez brothers.
The Perez brothers is one.
They're brothers,
but they're brothers.
Oh yeah, they're actually brothers.
Butcher brothers?
But the other ones that we had on weren't brothers. And the Butcher brothers also aren't brothers.
No.
Sometimes, and I feel like part of me is saying don't say this because people won't like it or whatever, but I feel like sometimes people are co-direct because they, it's like, don't have the guts to just direct themselves.
Oh, man.
I'm not saying this is perfect.
Okay. I'm not about this. No, I know, but I have like, you know, a co-host is a co-director, you know, has a directing partner. anyways.
Whatever, and, we can cut this out.
No, we aren't cutting it out. It's all in.
And I just think sometimes it's like, it's a little less scary to do it with someone or it's not all on your shoulders. And so I understand the appeal of that, but like,
Coming from the co-host.
Well, I also think that it's like a
co-host.
It's like a really special relationship that, you know, not everyone can have.
Yes,
you know,
I agree with that.
And I mean, I haven't co-directed anything with anybody, so I don't think I have it. Obviously, you know, but I kind of wish I did sometimes. You know.
Yeah. I mean.
Anyways.
Yeah. I think there are times for it. I wouldn't suggest it always or commonly, but like, yeah, I mean, if you're, it definitely beats spending thousands of dollars flying back and forth from the US to Belgium when you don't have to, but you know, that I think there's moments when you can, co-directing is good, but I agree though, that it's kind of hard to, like, when you're directing something, you just have a vision of what you want. And it's kind of hard to describe that to somebody who could, you know, has the same kind of pull in a project. And that was a big struggle for us. It was like we had two different visions, and like it turns out we were kind of met in the middle, which at the end,
right, it happened to work out really well on your movie.
It wasn't like day one, hey, you tell me what you want and I'll tell you what I want and we'll meet exactly in the middle and that'll be perfect, yay. You know, it was like, it took a while to get to that point, you know. So
So, how much footage did you shoot between that period of August 2014?
Can I go back in time?
Sure, go back in time.
You read the Wall Street Journal article and you go like, "This is it. You know, we found our feature. There's enough meat on this bone. We can make a full documentary about this." And you guys are excited to do it. So now, how does that funding come together? And I know a little bit of the answers. Like, I know there was some crowdfunding and I know there's, right, some people who are involved in this event have money, but mm-hmm. what was the idea of how it would come together and how did it actually come together? I don't know if I feel like on this podcast, so much of it is about how to get the money to actually make a project.
Yeah. I mean, let me think. So
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's, or maybe it's more like, altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Besides not having money, one of the biggest issues we had was that it was so time sensitive. Like, you know, we, you know, basically decided to do this less than a year until the actual reenactment. So we had to get the whole story, you know, filmed, and, you know, basically the whole story shot before the reenactment happened. So it was like, okay, it's a race against time to both get everything we need, but also get the money we need to get everything we need. In terms of funding, I'm trying to think what we did first. We found one private investor in Europe, I think, who was kind of in this world, and he gave us like enough money to basically shoot the first couple months and create a trailer. Once we did that,
In the reenactment community connected to you that this kind of patron guy?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the person who funded us in the beginning is a reenactor. So
okay.
That's another issue always with funding, especially in documentaries, is that you have this, you know, potentially very niche like story. You know, you have this like, I mean, you know, if you said Napoleonic reenactors in Belgium and France, that's not like, you know, cha-ching, you know, you're not making like box office millions of dollars. So, you know, you have to find people who are just interested in the subject matter, usually to at least start with the bankroll process. So this guy helped us. And then, the crews in Belgium especially are very inexpensive. It's kind of crazy. Like, you know, the day rates there were much lower than we charge here in the US. And so that made it much easier to kind of shoot for several days in a row. So we got a trailer done, and then we did a crowdfunding push on Indiegogo, which was kind of, you know, successful. I don't know if we even hit our goal, but we put our goal pretty high, which was something that we kind of went back and forth on, but we
can you share those numbers with us?
I think we got like 22,000 on Indiegogo, which was good. I think we had put on like almost double that, maybe 40,000 for the goal.
Wow.
But you know, it was somewhat of an arbitrary number, I guess. I don't know. We had budgeted it out, but it wasn't like the, you know, we knew things were going to change. As we shot more and we started kind of editing like longer and longer pieces, you know, we started adding to the trailer. We made like a 15 minute reel, kind of an opening sequence. I found that like, the farther you get in the filmmaking process, and we had to get farther because the events were happening, but the farther you get, the easier it gets to raise money, because you kind of, you're almost, you know, getting closer to the finish line. Like, it's more tangible and not as abstract for an investor to come in and be like, well, I don't know if this is going to happen. You know, if you're already kind of, I guess it's just like putting skin in the game a little bit, but if you're, you know, the farther you are along, the easier it is for someone to help you finish in a way.
How did you find these investors? Was it just people that you knew in your network, or was it like just connections through that community, like the little, you know, branches that kept on branching out, or how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we found both. I mean, one of the investors was from the Bay Area. He's a CEO of this company that we did corporate video for. And I remember right in the beginning talking to him about the project, and he said, you know, he seemed very interested in it. And as we were like desperately looking for money, I remember that kind of memory popped in my head, and I just called him out of the blue, and he gave some money. So, and then, there's so many false starts with distribution groups. We were actually talking to Morgan Spurlock's company for a while. They were like really interested in this, pretty early on. And we got to the point of producing trailers specifically for them to try to convince them. And
how did that come about, or how did these other people you're pitching it, like, where do you start if you were going to other companies? Like, are you cold emailing companies that you thought have produced stuff like this in the past, or how did that?
We did a little bit, but with the Spurlock thing, I think it was the CEO, the guy I was just mentioning. He was on some panel with them at some conference, and he had just invested with us, and he mentioned it to Spurlock, and Spurlock was like, yeah, that'd be great, and he basically said, here's his email with, take this with a grain of salt kind of thing. Like, he probably says that to everybody. And we actually got like decently far. They ended up, I think some things with them where this was before Spurlock had any of his troubles, but like they had this film, this really great film at Sundance, right when we were talking to them, and that kind of derailed the conversation. It's all just like timing, and that I don't know, really how close we got with Spurlock and the group, but they were spending time talking to us. So I felt like, they weren't just blowing smoke, so I think it's just like, as like tiring as it sounds, you just gotta like try as many avenues as possible. And sometimes they're going to break. Most of the financing we got was either crowdfunding or just kind of 3 to 4 private investors around who, basically liked the project enough or thought it was interesting enough and could, stand to not get their investment back if that was the case, I think with the CEO, the company in the Bay Area, he was just like a big history buff. So that was, that's kind of how the conversation started.
Did you feel like you were, there's a term for this in fundraising, I forget what it is, but did you feel like you were pretty good at like scouting out who the good leads were, or were you doing a lot of pitching and getting a lot of rejections at the same time? Or were you able to kind of home in on like, these are the people who like have some money, are interested in this topic, I also have an interest in investing in filmmaking.
I mean, I think I thought I knew. I'm not sure if I was actually so good at it, but I think the hard part is to kind of temper your expectations. If when somebody gives you a response and it's not a no, then you have to make sure that you're not going to start thinking that this is going to happen, I guess. And I think I definitely was good at being able to say, okay, this person would be a good fit because, they like history, they're French, whatever, whatever the check boxes were. But I had, like anything, I don't think I had any idea if they were going to be interested or not. I definitely got better at making the pitch and kind of telling people why I think that this would be a good project for them. But unfortunately, it's such a crapshoot. Like, you just have to kind of go for it. And if someone says no, it might be just because, just a random thing. Like, they're just at that moment not interested in something like this or doing anything,
Well, it sounds like you were very good at prospect mining, which might be the term that I was trying to think of earlier.
Maybe. Yeah.
So we already know that it's on Netflix. I'm just curious, can you talk about, like, were you able to pay back your investors with that Netflix deal, or were there other deals that got made for the movie, or is it only on Netflix? Like, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we definitely did not pay back our investors with the Netflix deal. And in fact, we still don't know how much Netflix paid for the project, which is kind of crazy, but I guess this is kind of a cautionary tale. I'm trying not to be too negative about it, but we ended up getting finishing funds from a German company. I should have mentioned this before. I forgot about it until right now. We got finishing funds from a German company who came to us out of the blue. we were like editing and we shot everything. And this guy whose wife worked in the reenactment world, like she made dresses or something around that, came to us and, you know, basically had found our project through the Indiegogo site. And this was like a year after we did the crowdfunding. And he said, you know, I work with these production companies and they have some money. And I've always wanted to make a film about Mark Schneider, the American Napoleon. So, you know, we were like, that's great. This sounds like perfect. It just fell in our laps, which it did. And it was great. I mean, they, you know, probably provided half of the total budget at the end. We were able to get music produced. We were able to, you know, get a really good colorist, a really, really great editor. We shot a bunch of pickup stuff. We did a lot, but we kind of, and this might be a very common story, we kind of like signed away our control over the project. You know, we still own 70% of the equity in terms of the whole production, both the producers and the investors, but they had kind of had all the rights to try to sell the project. And whatever cost associated with that, you know, would be reimbursed first, all that kind of crap that usually happens. So they, you know, they didn't, right. Nothing really happened for a while. And then they told us that it got picked up by Netflix. And I think what happened was they sold it as a kind of package of films to Netflix. And I think, you know, from a resume and like, you know, standpoint and trying to get funding for other films and everything, like having a film on Netflix is great. I mean, I'm so happy that is the case, but it wasn't like people were bidding for our project and Netflix won the bidding. You know, they probably, because of their power and their kind of near monopoly on things, I think they're really able to just kind of scoop up everything they want and really pay nominal fees for it. And you know, in fact, not to be too much of a downer, but right when the Netflix deal came out, we had just put together a website, because as part of our deal, we were able to self-distribute in the US. So we put together a website where people could rent the film for, you know, $3.99 or $2.99. And that was right when it started streaming for free on Netflix. And so obviously anyone who wants to watch it for free can do that as long as they have a Netflix account. So that was kind of, you know, a frustrating part, but you know, I think, right. You know, apparently that they're supposed to give us the numbers for what they got from Netflix in February. There's, you know, it's possible there's some money there. I'm not really sure, but like, I'm not upset that the film is on Netflix by any stretch at all. I think it's great. And I think that a lot of people have watched it on Netflix. The whole reenactment community that I am connected to on Facebook and all that stuff is like, they're talking about it on Netflix. They love it, which is great. I mean, that's enough for me now. This movie was never going to make, you know, millions of dollars, but I think it is a little bit cautionary, you know, that a lot of filmmakers have gone through that, you know, what sounds like an amazing deal can always come back to bite you, or you have to kind of really think about it. We were kind of desperate to finish the film. We wanted to finish it. We want to do it right, and to do that, we need that funding and that. So that was great. Yeah.
Well, what usually happens to filmmakers is that it they make a deal, it goes to a distributor, and then it gets on iTunes or Hulu at best,
right.
and then the same thing happens, but it doesn't get on Netflix.
Right.
You know.
Right.
It's so true. At least it got on Netflix.
No,
and that's pretty good.
I should, of course, and I should really like.
Are you talking about my movie art?
You and 1,000 others, yeah. Basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. I can't, like, you know, my girlfriend's from Brazil and her friends were watching it. And, you know, like, that's amazing. It's to have that on there is incredible. I just wish that there was my bank account was a little bigger because of that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's the danger you go in when you make a movie of any kind is that getting the money back is really challenging.
Yeah, and
getting both, right? Like even I would, when you on the kind of getting a bad deal distribution wise and not making any money, right? That was my story on Day of Vengeance. And on the Fred Eaglesmith documentary, we've made our money back and a little more. selling it on his website and at his merch table, but probably I would trade that for it being on Netflix, almost definitely, because I feel like to the general public, like, oh, you made a movie that's like I can buy on a website. Like, that's not real. It's real if I can, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Real distribution is I can stream it on Netflix, because I mean, I realize there are other streaming platforms, but Netflix is what everyone has.
Of course. Yeah. And it's, yeah. And I think, like, you know, long term, it's going to be great. It's going to, you know, someone will know that it's on Netflix, and that might open up a great opportunity, you know? So, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's interesting just though that, like, to hear everyone, a lot of people who like may not work in the film world say, oh my God, you know, it's on Netflix. You must be, you made it, you know, it's like basically means it means that you're like a uber successful filmmaker now, just because your film is on Netflix.
Right. Isn't maybe right. Not uber successful, but successful in some way that say Ulrich and I aren't.
No. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, just because it's on Netflix.
True.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a big thing now. And it's funny how, like, when Isaac made Day of Vengeance, like, you know, like, well, at least I'll get it on Netflix was sort of a thing that you would think,
right.
You know, and then that didn't happen, which was, you know, disappointing. But, like, right. Now it's, like, totally flipped.
Right.
Now it's, like, Netflix is now a high pedestal to get to.
Right.
Whereas before it was, like, oh, they'll take almost anything.
Like a fallback, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So... I mean, I have a lot more questions, but I mean, I don't want to go way over. Isaac, do you want to just like have one more question each before I wrap things up, or what do you want to talk about?
Yeah, whatever you want. I'll ask one more when you're done.
Yeah, so I'm kind of curious. You know, and this is sort of spoilery, but I just sort of want to know with the post process, or just in general. But like, did you know about Mark's criminal record when you started this, or did that something that you like found out as you were making the movie?
No, I very much knew about it, and I very much wanted to make that like a big part of it.
Yeah,
I think the article, I'm trying to remember right now. I think the original article that I mentioned before, mentioned it, but it mentioned it in a way that like he'll be able to come back from it. So I guess to let everybody know, they can find out, but Mark, the American Napoleon, had a something happened to him, or I guess he did something that was a criminal act that he was still, you know, being punished for when the film was being made. And that was casting some doubt on his ability to be Napoleon at a reenactment. So,
and yeah. Do you ever say what it is in the movie, or you don't?
Well, yeah, we allude to it. I mean, I think that was,
yeah, you allude to it.
He says it.
We just don't know exactly what the right.
Yeah. So Mark would never talk about.
But it. I like that we're not saying.
Yeah.
Oh, because why? I don't know. Whatever.
I mean,
no, leave it for people to. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was the one thing he would not talk about. He was very coy about all this stuff. Like, he was also, you know, he was going through the legal process at the time. He was, you know, covering all the bases to make sure that, like, you know, nothing would leak out and he would, and something bad would happen to him and blah, blah. But my whole, when I was starting the project, I was like, this is going to be the best redemption story ever. This is a guy who's going through this legal issue. He's going to get past it. At the last minute, he's going to ride his horse to Waterloo and be Napoleon. And like, he's going to win. And that was my whole, like, I'm an American. Here's the underdog story that we all want, you know,
right.
You know, and,
right.
And like, I think I might've pushed him a little too much on like playing that up. Like in my mind, that was great. And in his mind, he's like, I'll tell you about everything else you want except for this story. Like, stop asking me about it, you know? And so, yeah, we definitely knew about it. And it was something we tried to get other people talked about it. And he wouldn't. And that was something that we kind of played with a little bit. Like, there's something that about him that we know that everyone else doesn't know. And, you know, that, we did not find that out during, we knew before. And I think we were really trying to to really make that a bigger story than he wanted it to be, I guess.
And, right.
You know, I think, right. you know, we, yeah, like we try, you know, I think we were gonna, we played with some ideas of like reenacting that, having someone else reenact that. And I think we were walking on eggshells a little bit around him because he could have like cut us off from his character at any point. And that would, right. and that would have been a big issue for us. Cause at that time the film was called Napoleon versus Napoleon. So it would have just become Napoleon versus blank, you know,
that would have been, that would have been a problem. Yeah. Isaac, you go.
You know, so much of this podcast just...
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's... Or maybe it's more like... Altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together. Celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
As a listener, has been about...
I feel like I'm being judged here. This podcast is all about this, and we only talk about that on the podcast, so we have to talk about this some more.
Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about whatever you want. You're the co-host.
Yeah, but this is what I want to talk about. Okay, I want to talk about things that are relevant to the whole arc of the entire series.
Okay.
It's a lot about getting first features off the ground. So you did that and you got real distribution that we covered, right? Success on Netflix and everything. And so now you're going second feature like documentary. And I guess I'm wondering what the differences are. Do you feel like it is any different? Is it easier this time around?
I don't know about easier. I think I'm like more prepared for, I think that like the pre-production side of it is like what you have to get more prepared for and like learn how to manage more than like the shooting part. So with all of our work we do, you know, we can show up and we can shoot stuff. We know how to like make a shot list and do everything we need to do and make things look great and make people comfortable and everything. But it's really about, and I guess it depends, but in documentary, it's really about making the characters and the whole community that you're shooting like trust you and feel comfortable with you. So with the Napoleon documentary, like, as I, you know, I said that they were very comfortable on camera, which is true, but they're also very, very, paranoid that we were going to make fun of them because I guess everyone else does. So, you know, that we had to like build their trust. And so that took me a little while to understand that was going on with this new documentary, which is about high school basketball teams in Portland, Oregon, in the Northeast Portland neighborhoods. It's a different group of people, but it's the same process of like having them trust me as someone who's going to as someone who's going to be there every day and like understanding that what my intentions are. So I think I learned a lot about, you know, being more open and clear in the beginning about what I'm trying to do and what I'm doing there, as opposed to I'm just going to be here and see what happens kind of attitudes, which I employed a little bit with the reenactors. And I don't think that always works, because yeah, it's good for when you're filming, it's good to just kind of be a fly on the wall kind of thing. But when you're trying to trust people to call you when things happen, to be open on camera, to, you know, to like basically document their lives, they have to trust that you're doing something that they're going to be okay with, or at least somewhat okay with. So, yeah, I think this time it's been easier because I realized that a lot earlier, and it was like,
so it sounds to me kind of like, it's easier because of growth as a filmmaker, but not easier in the sense of like,
it's not easier communal.
Now I'm established and I have, you know,
no, it's not
funds that are at my disposal or whatever.
No, Netflix did not return my calls for this film, but, no, but I mean, they, you know, I don't think it's much easier because of like, yeah, it's easier to raise money. Yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit, not because of my being established, but just because of like, I know how to ask certain people for money in groups for it. But yeah, it's much easier in terms of the development side and understanding how to develop something and like a lot of that work. Cause like you guys probably experience the same thing when you are shooting something, you want to start shooting it and like get to that part of it. And like, that's the fun part, you know, you want to shoot and you want to like get home and look at the footage and see what you have, you know? And then, but with these documentaries, you really have to like, I think put in the work earlier to make sure that when you get to shooting, that these people are comfortable and understand what you're doing, you know, without it getting to a point of like directing them on exactly what to do. But, it's about kind of making yourself like just showing up every day kind of thing. And then they see that they kind of trust you that way. And then you kind of let them know what your intentions are and what you're planning to do for the next few months and what they should call you about when something happens, you know, cause you're not the first thing on their mind ever. You know, when you're making a documentary, you like, I want this character to call me if something happens with his son or whatever. But they're not thinking about you. So, you know, they're like the sixth person you think about when something happens. So, I think that's made it easier this time.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's a little unfortunate that, you didn't have a direct connection with Netflix on, you know, being Napoleon, because one of my thoughts was like, once you're in the Netflix family, it's like, oh, just call up Netflix and, you know, they'll, give you an exclusive and fund your next project and stuff. And yeah, it doesn't sound like that's happening at 1080 degree.
No, I don't have the secret handshake or anything like that.
Yeah.
My film's on there. That's it. So, yeah.
Nice. Well, that's something, you know.
Yeah. That definitely counts. Right.
I think the things you're talking about are great because they're not external things. They're like internal ways you've become a better filmmaker, you know, applying the things you learned and how to get what you want on the screen. But nice to have some outside validation. So I'm sure that
yeah,
just saying that it's on Netflix, even if it's like, well, now it's not easy to raise money, whatever, it's going to be whoever you're pitching to, that's more impressive than if it wasn't on Netflix.
Of course, yeah.
Right. And it's an easy like thing. Like if you're trying to get to know somebody or you want to tell them what kind of filmmaker you are, it's so much easier for them to watch your movie. You can be like, hey, like, you know, here it is. It's on Netflix, Being Napoleon. Yeah. Just check it out, you know.
Well, I like to drop the Netflix thing kind of like under my breath and see if people actually hear it.
Oh.
Not, you know, it's like not the bolded word in the sentence. It's like,
right,
I'm talking about the film and I just throw in the Netflix thing at the end and see if their face lights up or not.
Right. So the last question on this list is one I really want to ask just because I'm curious, and I think about this and I think I know the answer, but like, Do you, at this point in your filmmaking career, do you feel like you have an idea of like the kinds of movies you want to make going forward? Or is it really just like the thing that comes to you that you have interest in at the time? And like, you know, like you're doing a basketball movie now and, you know, you just did a reenactment movie before that. And like, okay, now who, maybe I'll do a documentary about oil rigs next. Like, is it completely random? Like, or did you have like a path of any kind that you're following?
It's a hell of an idea. Yeah. No, I think that like, I wouldn't say that there's like, a type of film that I want to do. I think that, I don't know. I guess like kind of both, because I have, I know what you were going to ask me about, like, do I have one project at a time or do I think about other ones? And I have like a list of 15 different films that I would like that have kind of crossed my mind at some point. And they're all pretty different, you know, it's like something, you know, just random stuff that I read about or I hear about or I see. And you know, some of those things, like, you know, I kind of lose interest in some of those things, kind of pop up, whatever. But you know, I think, I mean, I don't, trying not to be like too cliche about it, but like, if, to me, it's really like these stories that are either what people are doing that a lot of people don't know about that I think also could be interesting in terms of someone having a goal, you know, someone having like something that they're going after, or some subculture of our society that's just like doing something totally random to us, but which seems, you know, but when you get into it, it seems it's really interesting. But always with like, you know, always more than just like, okay, here's a subculture of people, look what they do, and then that's it. It's more of like, there has to be some story there. There has to be some like goal that someone's going for or something, you know, whether it doesn't have to be as obvious as a basketball game or a championship or a, you know, a Napoleonic competition, but there has to be some storyline there that someone is after. And like the one time I, you know, talked to an editor who said, you know, any project that you're going to work on, you know, basically if you can just ask one main question about what the character is after or trying to find out, and there's like a concrete answer to that, then you probably have a good project that you know, that has meat on its bones, basically. So, you know, I think it's just like finding a character or a group of people or a subject that for whatever reason interests you, and then exploring to see if that actually has enough there to make something out of. And that's kind of what I've done, I guess. I mean, you know, a lot of, like, sports documentaries are just inherently great anyway. So they're just, so a lot of times that's what I've deferred to or what I've been interested in. But, you know, I mean, there's, yeah, I guess my answer is that I just, whatever kind of comes across my brain at that moment and seems interesting to me, I kind of ask those questions or kind of go through that process to see if it's possible. And then, you know, and then it goes on this list of like, here's some possible projects. And then once in a while, I like see if there's anything there and go for it. I mean, you know, Isaac and I talked about the, like a documentary about this other singer-songwriter guy, Joe Pug, that would be amazing. That has nothing to do with any of these subjects that I've done. But I feel like he's like someone that a lot of people don't know about, who I think is great, who could also be going after some kind of goal in the film, and which I think would make a really cool project. So I think that's my process, really. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So where can people find your work, Jesse, besides on Netflix?
So my website is bywaterfilms.com, bywaterfilms.com. And the Casualties of the Gridiron doc series is at casualtiesofthegridiron.com, and there's also a YouTube page of that, and Netflix for Being Napoleon.
Nice. Yeah. And do you still have a website for Being Napoleon, or is it down now?
Oh yeah, there's actually a beingnapoleonfilm.com where you can actually pay for the film if you don't want to watch it on Netflix, which would be awesome.
So all people who love it should just buy it, or who love French you know, reenactments or reenactments of any kind, historical reenactments, you should buy the movie.
Yeah,
for sure.
You can download it like 3 times if you want. It'd be great.
Nice. Isaac, before I do my outro, you have any last words, last questions, last anythings?
No, but I've enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for being our guest, Jesse.
You're welcome. Thank you guys. You're a great, yeah, man. You're a great guest co-host, Isaac.
Thank you.
Yeah, you did a good job. It's awesome. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Jesse once again for being on the show, and Isaac for co-hosting. You can check out our website at MickeyMoviesIsHard.com. We can find the links to the things we talked about on this episode, including being Napoleon. If you want to get in contact with us, you can send an email to podcast@MickeyMoviesIsHard.com, or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at MMIHPodcast. And I'm at AlrickB on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and Isaac is at Isaac Pingree on Twitter. Isaac, anywhere else you want people to go to check you out?
No, that's all right. I don't know. My website is lagoonside.com, LAGOONSIDE. And then while I'm interrupting you in the middle of your outro, which I just say thanks for inviting me to guest host with you this episode.
Yeah.
And then also thanks to Timothy for figuring out how this podcast works with you. Cause I think while I've been doing this, I've been thinking like it's, there's like, you know, whatever, there's like a formula that, you know, you guys developed, and then I just feel like it makes sense to me, and I just have to kind of fill in for him.
Right. Right. I wonder if the other co-hosts feel the same way. They're like, if everyone's just thinking they're filling in for Timothy. I think all the co-hosts were listeners previous guests, so I think they probably maybe have some kind of thought process like that, but we're about to get some people who aren't huge fans of the show be co-hosts soon, so that's
I really was a huge fan of the show.
Well, you listen to almost every episode. I mean, you've listened to like at least 100, right?
I'm not sure.
Yes, you have. I know that. You were listening every week for a while. I mean, maybe
there's like a lot of episodes. I mean, I listen. Yeah. I listen regularly. What the percentage is?
Yeah,
it's okay. Probably in the 40 or 50%.
Well, I'll take
it. Take that. Yeah. Good.
All right. And please, lastly, if you like the show,
see how I started with something really nice there, and then it turned into me. anyway.
It's okay. Timothy, you're well loved and respected. He's not even listening to the show anymore, so Timothy stopped listening, but he might listen again. So Timothy, you're well respected and appreciated by everybody. That's what Isaac's trying to say. Yeah, if you like the show, tell a friend, help us get the word out, leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And thanks again, Jesse, for a fantastic show. And yeah, talk to you guys next week.
All right, thank you guys.
All right, it is time for You're the Expert. What is You're the Expert, you ask? This is a segment created by Eric Toms, our producer, where he basically has a bunch of questions that have either sent in or that he finds from other filmmaker friends or whatever. These are just like a collection of questions that filmmakers have as they getting started or working on their films. So here is this week's question. It says, hey all, I want to learn more about writing and making films, but what makes me nervous is that there are so many programs and organizations online. I'm afraid I'm going to choose the wrong one or get scammed. Who should I go to in order to learn more about different programs and which is the right one? And I think they mean like probably script, you know, contests, classes, courses, different organizations like IFP or ISA or...
It's a pretty broad question.
It's a pretty big question. Yeah. So I don't know. What would you say, Liz, to people out there?
What comes to mind is before embarking on these programs is to set a budget for yourself. Pick a number in your brain or do the math of what can you afford to lose. And that doesn't mean it's going to be thrown down the toilet, but what is dispensable income that you could use towards your own personal development as an artist? And don't go beyond that budget, because I think that's the path to resentment. And I think the other key to this is there is no scam, because yeah, there may be people who are less qualified to charge a certain amount of money to do what they do. And that's why you have the budget going in, right? You think to yourself, I'm not going to spend more than X on this level of personal development. So I think it's about qualification, but I don't think there's anyone out there who's like, I'm going to fuck over all these indie filmmakers and I'm going to charge millions of dollars and I'm just going to take all their money. I don't believe that that villain, Scrooge McDuck villain, exists. But I do think there are people who are just have too much confidence for their level of expertise. And I think that's what you need to navigate, is avoiding those people. But what I wanted to add is that even if someone is unqualified, your goal is to still get something out of it, right? So if you want to write a script, find a program that has a deliverable of writing a script. Like, their goal for the program is to hold you accountable for writing the script. Like, really be super targeted, because there are, like Ulrich was saying, there's just a gazillion of these consultants, these programs, these labs, these fellowships, these master classes, these workshops. They all call themselves a different thing. And I wouldn't just spray randomly. Like, I would just pick one that is uniquely targeted to what you want to do. You can ask for references if you really want to. You can go on Facebook and crowdsource some thoughts. I would say, like, I can't think of a program I have attended that really changed my world. Ultimately, what helped me most of all was finding peers to support my efforts, and then I would support theirs, and then just writing the script, making the movie. Like, the most like fertile ground for you to learn is doing. Ulrich, do you have recommendations of specific programs? Because I honestly have never done any of these programs.
Well, I think it's not on Story. Maybe it's on Story. There's a couple of these pitch programs I went through. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember what one of them was, and I heard from some people at Austin Film Festival that they had a really good experience with them. Gosh, it's not on Story. It's like Story Roadmap Writers. That's what it is. Okay. Roadmap Writers. So this one I did like 5 or 6 of these Roadmap Writer pitches, and I had a good experience. And then I met somebody who found their agent or manager through Roadmap Writers. So they had like done a series of pitches, and then one of them was successful. They got their team, and they're like writing on a show now, you know? So that was kind of cool, you know, to hear that like this thing that I had done that I hadn't gotten like huge success out of actually really worked for somebody else. So, you know, that's one. I think The Blacklist is another one that people use a lot. And I'm not talking about The Blacklist that gets printed every year. I'm talking about Blacklist, which is like a kind of related program that is, what's his name? Franklin Leonard, I think is the guy's name.
Yeah.
And it basically, it's like a whole database of scripts that you can put your script onto, and you pay like a certain monthly fee. And then like it's a one-time fee to like load your script up there. And then it gets kind of pumped out to all these different producers and agents and managers and people who are looking for scripts. And then you get a rating when you do it. So you get rated, and, you know, depending on if you get like an 8 or a 9 or a 10, like people are going to be really excited to like talk to you. And I've had people who like, you know, that I know who's gotten like 8, 9s and 10s who've like gotten meetings with managers and gotten like actual the progress through that.
Yeah.
I only got 5s or 6s, so that wasn't me. And I feel like those ratings are bullshit, because like I basically got like I think 1 5 and then a 6 on the alternate, and that was like, you know, whatever, like nothing special. But then I made the movie, and the movie did really well. So like, you know, fuck these guys. Like, they don't really know what they're talking about. So I just think that it's all really good, like, experience to go through these programs and to do these things. But you're right. It's super expensive, and it can get, there's ones that are like way, way more expensive, like thousands of dollars to get coverage on your script, you know, thousands of dollars to like, you know, have someone tell you what, you know, if they think it's like, what will make your script sell or whatever. And then like, I get these emails all the time from these people who are like, do you want to know how to actually raise money on your film? Like, you sign up and I can actually get you investors and you can actually make your movie. And it's like, dude, like if it was that easy, everyone would be using your program. You know, it's like, it's not that easy,
right? But if you derive value for, like, if it changes your perspective and confidence level. Like, maybe this is because I'm a consultant that I'm like, they're not all bad, guys. Not all consultants are bad. But yes, when they're really reductive and they're like, I'm going to transform your world, like, that's dangerous. These kind of like scammy, overzealous marketing efforts.
Yeah, raise the budget for your feature now in three easy steps. It's okay. Yeah, right. And I'm sorry, Liz, there are scammers out there. There isn't. I wish it was true. I wish there were no scammers, but there are. I talked to this filmmaker, or he's not even a filmmaker, he's like a writer, a comic book writer, who has this movie that he wants to make. And he like met this person at some sort of event or something who does product placement for your films.
We've already talked about Rolf. Rolf has been mentioned on this podcast a few times.
Yeah, it's totally a scam. There's no way that's not a scam.
It's just he's not promising a conversion. He's saying, I'm going to do this effort and you're going to give me this money. That's not a scam. It just means it's ineffective.
If he'll take your money when there's no script, it's a scam. There's no way that if he's going to like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do a consultant on you for product placement on your comic book that doesn't have a script, like what are they paying for?
I think there's a world where there could be value there. I just think so it's up to us to protect our colleagues from making bad decisions.
I love that you know this person, by the way. That's
we
amazing.
Brought Rolf up a lot.
I know, but it's just like, it's totally like Rolf.
Oh, I'm not friends with Rolf. I've never worked with Rolf.
It's not a scam. Well, it's totally.
I would say people probably think is a scam, right? Because I'm like, give me money. I can't guarantee you distribution. I'm going to basically talk with you for a year and support you and try to get you the home that you need. But I can't say I'm going to get your money back on your film. I can't say, like, I can't promise any deliverables.
That's where it's not a scam, because you're not promising anything. You know,
the issue is when they overpromise. Yeah, that's a scam. I guess I'm starting to see it a little bit.
And they're like basically saying, like, give us this money and then we'll get you this placement, which will raise the budget for your movie. It's like, no, it won't.
Right.
It's not happening. Right. It's not happening for you, dude. It's just the fact that they'll take your money makes me know it's a scam. Because if they looked at your project and they were like, oh yeah, no, we're not actually gonna be able to do this, like, let's not move forward, then I'm like, okay, you're legitimate. Like, you're not, you know, but if the fact that you would take someone's money, knowing, like, looking at their project, like, there's no way that this is gonna result in a placement, you know, until there is way many more pieces in line. It's like, that's where it's like, they're just taking money from you, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so and it's funny that like this question comes up, because I'm working through like submitting my script to programs and, you know, contests and, you know, funding it's a funding initiative or some sort of like program where like you submit your script and like it's not for a contest, it's for a film fund, basically. You know, I'm just being very picky on which ones, and I'm basically what you said, like, knowing that like I have a budget where I know that I could lose all my money and I'm okay with, like, I'm not get a return or not win or whatever, and I'm okay with that. But it's just like the experience of going through the process and submitting, and like, you know, maybe something will come of it, but maybe something won't, and that's okay. You know, I think it's really hard to find out which are the good ones, but I do a lot of Google searches and like top 10 lists for screenwriting contests. I feel like if you look at four top 10 lists, or like two top 10 lists and like a top 25 list, and then you start to see the same things over and over again, I think that's a pretty good way to like tell like if these are legitimate or not. Yeah, I mean, asking people, trying to find people who've actually gone through the programs and done them, I think that's another good way to figure out like if they're legitimate or not.
Or see if there's like an hourly. I think the issue is like a lot of these packages come with like, well, a lot of these come as packages, like a 10 class package or a 10 whatever. And it's like, try a one-off. Have a half hour, have an hour with this person. Are they inspiring you? Do you feel like they're instilling some sort of value in the project? Proceed.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you are right that like most of these people are meaning well, and they are trying to bring value to you and to your project and to your process, you know, and it is very few and far between where they are actual like straight up like illegitimate scam systems or whatever. And maybe they're not all completely, you know, bad. Like maybe they're like, they do work for some people, but like, you know, you have to be really aware of like, oh, is this actually going to work for me and my project, you know, before handing over your money, because they're not going to tell you it's not. Like, they're going to take your money because they want it. They're not going to tell you that your project's not ready for the X program or X contest or X thing. They're just going to take your money. So like, you have to do the research to realize, am I there yet or am I not there yet? You know, what do I actually need to get my project to the next step, or hit my goals. But what do you guys think? Like, have you had people scam you? Have you gone through programs that have actually worked? Has this Rolf guy actually gotten product placement in your movie and helped you raise your budget? I want to know. Send us a comment, send us a question or a suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you really like the show, you can leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, which is really great. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Moves Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's, or maybe it's more like, altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.
Feel the pulse of the city. Feel the beat of the drum. Feel the bass blow your hair. In Las Vegas, live music delivers much more than sound. It's where music comes alive. With artists like Megan Thee Stallion, Maroon 5, Carrie Underwood, Shania Twain, Babyface, Lionel Richie, and many more. Every show is a playground for your senses. See the full summer lineup at visitlasvegas.com.
Treat dad to the good stuff at Nordstrom Rack and save big. Father's Day is Sunday, June 16th, and Nordstrom Rack's got gifts dad will love, up to 60% off. Shirts, activewear, watches, cologne, denim, and more. Find amazing deals on Tommy Bahama, Cole Haan, Original Penguin, and Vince. Great brands, great prices. So get to your Nordstrom Rack store now and make dad's day with gifts up to 60% off.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.